welcome Christopher Moll, who's an associate professor of philosophy at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Although right now, he's based in Edinburgh as the American Philosophical Association Fellow for the Institute of...
The Advanced Study of the Humanities.
Sorry, I just heard this. That's as far as I could remember. So he's come down from Edinburgh, despite our having thought you'd be in London. Anyway, thank you for coming across ocean and then south. So just to tell you a little bit about Chris, he's written two books. One, Attention is Cognitive Unison from 2010, and one that's just come out, The Unexplained Intellect, Complexity, Time, and the Metaphysics of Embodied Thought. And Chris mainly, as you can probably tell from that, works in philosophy of mind, but also has written on aesthetics, for example, on fictional objects and reference and performance in poetry. And today he's going to be talking to us about beauty is objective, not beauty if objective, contrary to the signs that were outside. And before I hand it over to Chris, I just want to thank the British Society of Aesthetics for funding this series. All right, Chris, take it away.
Thank you very much. Thank you all for coming. It's very pleasing to be here. It's an invitation I was very pleased to have. So as basically just sort of indicated to you, the thing I do most of is philosophy of psychology. But I always feel a bit sort of, when you're talking to aestheticians, that like being a part-time aesthetician sounds like a terrible thing to be. I spend as much time thinking about aesthetics as I spend thinking about anything. I just have less to say about it. So this talk is really a very much a kind of fundamental aesthetics, kind of meta-aesthetics-y sort of topic about beauty. Now you might have thought that beauty would be the central topic of concern in aesthetics. And maybe there was a time when that was true, but it ain't so anymore. And there was sort of a distinctive thing that happened some point towards the end of the last century where, well, beauty kind of became a bit suspect. And beauty became separated from aesthetic value. That's the crucial thing. You get a lot of people in philosophy and in various kinds of theories of criticism who are very suspicious of beauty, who think beauty is merely a kind of superficial charm and a kind of arbitrary charm. On the other hand, you get a lot of stuff in the arts where artists just stop caring about beauty. Or don't stop caring about it, but kind of actively defy it. And you sort of see this in there's a distinctive kind of willingness to produce music that's not pleasing, not immediately pleasing to listen to. And in the visual arts, you think about someone like Francis Bacon, where you get this kind of aggressive interaction with ugliness. But it's not just a highbrow thing. So also if you think about things like thrash metal music, very distinctively late 20th century phenomenon, very much concerned with the idea that you can create art that has value as art, but that doesn't depend on its beauty in order to have such a value. Okay, so then a bunch of philosophers at the very beginning of this century started to worry about whether or not we should be trying to rehabilitate beauty as an aesthetic concept. And I'm kind of on the side of that movement. I want to suggest that beauty, if we abandon beauty, we abandon something really of the first importance. I would say even if we do want to separate out aesthetic value from beauty, it's not like everything valuable goes on the side of the aesthetic value. Beauty is itself a thing of value to which we are committed. So that, I take it, is that's worth saying, because there's a widespread view, not just because of this sort of artistic movement, but there's a widespread view in, not just in philosophy, but also, I think, you encounter when you speak to the man on the street, who thinks that beauty is, I've said that beauty was sort of began to be looked at as a kind of superficial charm by certain feminist theorists and others, but there's also a sense that you get from the man on the street that the pursuit of beauty is a kind of indulgence. So this is sort of view of beauty that I want to reject, is what I call the indulgence view. And that says, you know, there's some people that go in for beauty and seek it out and try and create it and all that sort of stuff. And, you know, that's fine. But it's sort of on a par with being keen on spicy curries or fast cars. Right now, I mean, and by those I mean like the non-aesthetic properties of those things. Right? Some people are really into beauty and good for them, and some people are really into fast cars and good for them, and like there's nothing particularly, the only thing that makes the pursuit of beauty seem like it has a special status is a kind of historical arbitrary privileging of that. For mostly regrettable reasons, power has tended to be in the hands of the people that had the leisure to pursue beauty, and there's kind of something politically suspect. There's kind of our discourse about beauty is actually, and this is where this sort of view, this indulgence view of beauty, I think is something that you find in French writing a lot, and I think Pierre Bourdieu is sort of the locus classicus for this idea that, so because it belongs very much in that French tradition, this idea is that you kind of make this deconstructivist move at this point, and you say, in fact, when you look at our discourse about beauty and you deconstruct it, you find that really all the people are doing is something like showing off, is something like trying to position themselves socially by making claims about which sort of things they find beautiful. It's all about identity. Okay, so that's the indulgence view of beauty. It says beauty is just this privileged, arbitrarily privileged taste. The more we go in for it, we're just indulging ourselves, and moreover, we kind of shouldn't indulge ourselves in that way, because to do so is politically suspect. And the view that I want to, is sort of diametrically opposed to that, that I want to endorse myself, says no. Beauty is a kind of basic value on a par with truth. So just as you can, as soon as you are a person with a mind at all, you cannot avoid being a person who has beliefs, and to have beliefs is already to be committed to truth as a value. It's already to be in a position where you would have gotten wrong if you have a false belief, and you would have gone right for you if you have a true belief. So that it just comes with being a creature with a mind that you are committed to truth. You're not obliged to believe every truth, of course. But there's a sense in which truth is one of the values you have to live by. And I would say beauty is on a par with that. And on a par with, it emerges in a similar way. So just having a mind is enough to put you in a position where you're committed to the truth. But a mind is not just a hoard of sentences. And because the mind is not just a hoard of sentences, truth is not the only relevant criterion by which to judge its relationship to the world. If we're just talking about things like sentences, then truth tells you all you need to know, but there's more to having a mind than just having a collection of sentences. So there's a kind of engagement with the world that comes with being mindful, and I think that is properly directed on the beautiful. So just as you're kind of obliged to believe the true. It just kind of comes with what it is to have beliefs. There's this idea of beauty that says you're kind of obliged to love the beautiful. Insofar as you've got a mind, you can't but go in for having beliefs, and that commits you to truth. Insofar as you've got a mind, you can't but go in for some more affective engagement with the world, and that commits you to loving the beautiful. So, this view that I want to contrast with the indulgence view is the obligation view. It says there is an unescapable obligation to value beauty. Now, those are two extremes on a spectrum. There's plenty of room between the two. I think part of what's pushed people, as I've already indicated, there were lots of divergent paths that took them there, but part of what's pushed people towards going for the indulgence end of the spectrum is the sense that the obligation end of the spectrum is untenable. And one reason why you might think that the obligation end of the spectrum is untenable is that you might think, well, look, when you look at what the... You might say that this, the kind of deconstructivist, the kind of Bourdieu-ish picture of aesthetic discourse is correct. In fact, when you look at people who are talking about beauty, really, they're not engaged in stating beliefs. So there the idea is that it can't be true that the facts about beauty place us under an obligation, because there really aren't any such facts. Right? If you think there are facts about beauty, you've kind of been, according to this view, you've kind of been taken in by this socially entrenched bluff. Right? There's all these fancy people that you meet in art galleries who go around saying, oh gosh, isn't this beautiful? But you know, they're just showing. Well, there's two ways you can think about this kind of view. You could sort of think about it on a par with ethical expressivism. So you could say that really people that go in for that kind of talk about beauty, they're not really expressing a belief. What they're doing is giving voice to some non-cognitive attitude, giving voice to the gratifying nature of their experience. But it's not stating a belief. And a kind of variation on that theme is to talk about beauty not on a par with the way in which the expressivist thinks about ethical discourse, but on the way that the kind of scientific anti-realists think about the scientific discourse. So the scientific anti-realist says, when a scientist puts forward a theory, they're not really saying they believe it. They're just saying, here's a way you can look at the world. It'll enable you to make the right sorts of predictions. Now, notice that this isn't an especially deep point. It's just a kind of, maybe it's a burden of proof shifting point. Notice that those kind of anti-realisms are quite strong claims and therefore quite hard to make plausible. So it's not enough to be an anti-realist about some body of discourse to say that that body of discourse is sometimes used for non-truth-stating purposes. Right. So you don't... Of course, the rhetoric of science is sometimes used for purposes of non-rational persuasion. Of course it is. That's not enough to justify a kind of strong anti-realism about science. Right? What you need to get an anti-realism, you need to show that the vocabulary is somehow unsuited for use in normal esoteric business. Right? So, if Jones shows Smith a photograph of his baby, and Smith says, oh, beautiful. Quite possibly not a statement of an aesthetic belief, right? Quite possibly just an expression of sympathy. But that's the fact that the word beautiful can be used in that kind of context. That's not enough to make you an anti-realist about beauty, right? Because look, there's lots of things that Smith might say that he doesn't really mean in that kind of way. Right? Smith says, "How are you?" Jones says, "Oh, I'm fine." Maybe he's thereby expressing the belief that he's fine, but maybe it's just one of these little phatic things that goes on. Right? You don't get to be an anti-realist just because the vocabulary is sometimes put to non-phatic, to phatic use, not to non-truth-stating use. To be an anti-realist about beauty, you need to think that beauty, talk is always used in that way. Talk about beauty is essentially unfitted for presenting one's commitments to facts. Okay, so just kind of just observing that some of, in a way that someone like Bourdieu does, some of the uses of the beauty discourse are liable to deconstruction. That's not enough to show that we shouldn't think that there really are facts about beauty. Just shows that some people sometimes show off. Okay, but I want to claim that that's all just sort of to make you think that the anti-realist claim is quite a strong claim. I want to claim it's not just that it's quite strong, it's something that we do not want to be committed to. It's something that we have a kind of pre-theoretical commitment against. So think about a more type paradox sentence, like this one. So we're being recorded for podcast purposes, so I'll read out the contents of my slides. The sentence just says, "This object is beautiful, and I do not believe this object is beautiful." That, it seems to me, generates a more paradox in just the way that sentences of this form normally do. Quite generally, any sentence where you state something and then claim not to believe it has been a paradox. You didn't believe it, you had no business stating it. And why is that a paradox? Where did the more paradox arise from? Well, the first conjunct looks like it expresses a belief. That's why it's in conflict with the second conjunct, which disavows that very belief. So it looks like stating that an object is beautiful is, because there's a paradox here, feels like the statement of a belief. Feels like, therefore, a commitment to it being true that the thing is beautiful. And notice that that is quite, that the ring of paradox that sentence one gives off is not shared by non-constitutive versions of it. So if instead of thinking about the disavowal of belief, we thought about the disavowal of some other attitude, you don't get the paradox, right? So the anti-realist does is disavow the idea that it's the normal truth norm, or normal truth derived norm. It's an operation here, and there are lots of different theories they might give of what it is that we're giving voice to. But it has to be when we say, "This is beautiful." So that's not really a belief. It's just giving voice to this gratifying experience or whatever. So we have to sort of give them quite a lot of latitude there as to what the way in which we are moved by beautiful things is. But they should say, if they want to say that attributions of beauty are really expressions of these being moved in some way, they should say that a sentence is a form of two, "This is beautiful, and it fails to move me," in some way, move in some non-truthy way, that should have to be a paradox for them. And it just doesn't, right? The paradox here is with one and not with two. Sentences like two, perfectly assertable. Why wouldn't you assert two? You might just commit to two as a way to express the fact that you were in a bit of a solemn sort of mood. Hamlet does it, after all.
In the What Appears of Work as a Man speech, he says, and this is crucial for my argument, this is when he's just stopped pretending to be mad. This is the very point when he's showing himself to be sane, just telling Rosencrantz and Guildenstern how he's been feeling. He says, what a piece of work is a man, the beauty of the world, apparently of animals, and yet, to me, what is this quintessence of dust? Like, man delights not me, nor woman neither. Right, that perfectly intelligible, perfectly free of any ring of paradox. Saying this is beautiful and it fails to move me, no problem. Saying this is beautiful and I don't believe this is beautiful clangs with all the force of a more paradox. So it cannot be right to say that the role played by attributions of beauty in our normal discourse is the expression of a non-constitutive attitude rather than of a belief. So that route doesn't seem to show that we should. That route doesn't make the aesthetic facts otios, right? You could still think that there are these facts. We seem to be committed to the existence of them when we make attributions of beauty. So you don't get that route for thinking that there are no such facts placing an obligation on us, right? And remember, that's the view I want to defend. That the facts about beauty place us under our obligation. We are required to love the beautiful, much as we're required to believe the true. Okay, so you don't get to resist that view by saying that there really aren't any such facts. But there's another view, and I think this other view is probably more popular, that says not that there are no facts about beauty. All of that discourse is just people showing off. But that, although there are facts about beauty, they're not the kind of facts that can place us under any interesting constraints. And they're not the kind of facts that place us under interesting constraints because the facts in question are highly dependent on the kind of responses we have. So that the kind of the problem here is easy, lends itself to being put in Wittgensteinian terms, right? Wittgenstein has that thing where he's talking about, well, if the fact that something seems right to me is enough to make it right, then you haven't really got a substantial concept of rightness that's applicable in these contexts. So someone might say, oh, aesthetic facts, but they can't place it under any obligation because they don't have any life outside of our responses. The fact that we're inclined to find something beautiful, the fact that we respond to it in a beauty-type way, that's enough to make it beautiful. That's all it is to be beautiful, is to prompt that kind of response. So this is the general worry. So the first worry I've addressed says there really aren't any facts about beauty. The second worry is there may be such facts, but they're subjective in a way that prevents them from placing us under any obligation. And I want to claim that that's a mistake. So, I think, yes, here's a pertinent quote from Nick Zangwill's Stanford Encyclopedia article on judgments of taste. He says, basic condition on being judgment of taste is that it is essentially subjective. This means that the judgment of taste is based on a feeling of pleasure or displeasure. It is this that distinguishes the judgment of taste from an empirical judgment. Central examples of judgments of taste, are judgments of beauty and ugliness. And this is just like paragraph one of his encyclopedia article. It's all meant to be very familiar and obvious that these judgments are subjective, and they're subjective because they're based on feelings of pleasure. Okay, so um,
you have to be a bit careful with this. There's a lot of people, once you start saying, oh, subjective, people get, there's a not unreasonable literature that says those terms of appraisal are frequently unhelpful and often used in variously oppressive ways. But I think there is, and maybe that's true, there is a whole sort of feminist critique of objectivity as an epistemic standard. But I don't think that should mean we flee from talking about this distinction. It should make us careful so that we make sure we're using it in a way that's not a tool of oppression. And I think there is a fairly simple intuitive contrast between objectivity and subjectivity that we can draw. And I'm surprised that it's not standardly drawn in this way, but I haven't found it being so. So consider a simple attribution of beauty of the sort that's reported in this sentence here. The sentence says, Jones judges Smith to be beautiful. Who is the subject of this sentence? Jones. There he is. Who is the object of this sentence? Smith. Very good. So, I'm not going to think that base, you know, it's easy to get confused. But that much should be familiar and obvious to us all. And that's the foundation on which to build the contrast between subjectivity and objectivity. If an attribution is subjective, it's made true by facts about the subject. If it's objective, it's just made true by facts about the object. That's the distinction. That's the vital distinction. So if you think about paradigm of a subjective judgment here, Jones judges Smith to be worrisome. Jones says, oh, I find Smith very worrisome. Jones is speaking truly, then there's some facts about Jones that make that true. Jones is prone to forming Smith very worrisome. There might also be constraints on Smith, but there are at least some constraints, certainly intrinsic properties of the subject in this case. Jones. Now, you might worry on this definition. I've just said, here was my definition. It was quick, but here it is again. Right, the subjective judgments place constraints on the truth of a subjective judgment. Places constraints on the intrinsic properties of the subject. So you have to add the truth a bit, right? Because any judgment places constraints on its subject in that you have to have the right concepts to make the judgment, right? But that's not the interesting distinction. It's not just that Jones has to know how to formulate the concepts of worrisomeness. In order for it to be true, Smith's worrisome, something has to be true of Jones. There's a distinctive constraint on the subject placed by the truth of the judgment. Whereas in the case of an objective judgment, the only constraints are on the objects, and those constraints needn't be intrinsic. And you might worry, as I say, that way of drawing the distinction makes it non-exhaustive. So there are going to be some properties that are neither subjective nor objective, because they place no constraints. That's all right by me. So maybe the property of being self-identical, neither an objective nor a subjective property, whatever. There's a bit more of a worry. These are worries expressed by a referee for a journal, as you might imagine. There's a bit more of a worry about, well, what if the subject is the object? Oh, yeah, that one is a problem. So in fact, you need a bit more of a... It's not just that the truth of the judgment places constraints on the subject, has to place constraints on the subject, qua subject. It's not. If it turns out that Smith is Jones,
then there are going to be constraints on Smith. But they're going to be constraints qua object.
Maybe that still gives us a definition that's a bit broad.
But it's okay for the purposes of the overall dialectic if I've defined subjective a bit broad, since after all I'm going to try and reject the claim that it's subjective. If I reject the bigger claim, I've rejected the smaller one with it. Okay. So are people happy? Yes? You've got this contrast that has had a bad reputation in the philosophical literature, or at least in feminist epistemology. It's not a bad distinction, right? There is a fairly clear distinction to be drawn between the subjective and the objective. Being worrisome, pretty clearly subjective. Notice, it will be important later, that being subjective is not at all the same as being context sensitive. So we sometimes are sloppy about that. Maybe not we in this room, but people at large are sometimes sloppy about that. Right? So they sometimes say, oh, well, you know, you say that Jones is very young, but that's very subjective. No, it's not. Right? Judging someone to be young, perfectly objective. Right? It's Smith. It's his youth that makes the judgment true or false. The standard I'm applying can change from context to context. And maybe in order to know where that standard is set in some particular context, it's useful to think about the subject and how old he is. But once you know what content was expressed, it's the object that you have to look at to know whether that content was true. Right, so context sensitivity is you take this bit of this, the word shifts its meaning in different contexts. Subjectivity says even once you've fixed the context, even once you know what the content is, to know whether that content is true, you have to look at the subject as well as the object. So subjectivity and context sensitivity are just different things. Okay. I think I've banged on enough about that basic distinction, so now I want to claim that beauty is objective. So if... Here's this thing about properties that are subjective. If a property is subjective, I've said now repeatedly, that if a property is subjective, then the truth of its attribution places constraints on its subject. And that means, should be possible for an attribution of a subjective property to go from being true to being false on account of some change to the subject. Right? Because there was a demand on the subject, an intrinsic demand on the subject. So Jones judges Smith to be worrisome. Let's suppose it's true. We could make it become false by making a change to Jones. Jones could just get over it. Okay. Now, because of that feature, because it's possible for the judgment to go from being true to being false, not the other way around necessarily, but at least to go from being true to being false, you can kind of hope that that's going to happen. So if you think about a traveller who's about to embark on some journey that's meant to be a sort of life-changing journey. The traveller can say to herself, this is all very familiar, and I hope I cease to find it familiar. Perfectly intelligible thing to hope. Intelligible because she hopes to change herself in such a way that it stops being true. Stops being familiar. Now, consider the version of that when you've got an attribution of beauty. This object is beautiful, and I hope that I will cease to find it beautiful. So this is kind of the intuition I want to encourage you to have, is that this just looks like a diachronic version of the Moore paradox again. Right? morality is objective, that's going to be right. Right? Because if it's beautiful, I think it's beautiful, to hope that I will cease to find it beautiful is to hope that I will come to have a false belief. Not that that's impossible to do, but it requires a kind of tension. It requires that my current lights are already being called into question. There's something, again, it's not impossible, but there's something funny about it. There's some ambivalence required in order to coherently judge something as beautiful and hope that you will cease to find it so. Whereas there's nothing. If the property were subjective, that should just be fine. That should be as unproblematic as saying, this is all very familiar, I hope I cease to find it so. This is all very worrying, I hope I cease to find it so. No paradox when the thing's subjective. When the thing's objective, there's a paradox. Objectivity is required to explain the a paradox. And I appeal to you to share my intuition that this genuinely is paradoxical. This kind of diachronic more feeling. In the written version of this paper, I try and use a bit of Paradise Lost at this point and kind of say that there's something Luciferian about this attitude of finding something beautiful and wanting to cease to find it beautiful. I realise there's a less melodramatic version of it if we just stick with Shakespeare. So if you think about what's going on in the Dark Lady sonnets, of things, but one of them is precisely this, that there's something, whereas with the Hamlet thing, it was like, nothing, that's not weird, that's just Hamlet telling us how it is. These things are beautiful, but they don't move me. Whereas, these things are beautiful, and I hope that I will cease to find them beautiful, that really requires, there's something funny going on there. That puts you into the kind of weird ambivalence that's characteristic of the Dark Lady attitude. So, this is the best example of that. I can't remember which number this is now, 137. Shakespeare writes, "Thou blind fool, love, what dost thou to mine eyes, that they behold and see not what they see? They know what beauty is, see where it lies, yet what the best is, take the worst to be. If eyes corrupt by over-partial looks be anchored in the bay where all men ride, why of eyes falsehood hast thou forged hooks whereto the judgment of my heart is tied? Why should my heart think that a several plot which my heart knows the wide world's commonplace? Or mine eyes, seeing this, say this is not to put fair truth upon so foul a face. In things right true, my heart and eyes have erred, and to this false plague are they now transferred." As I say, lots going on, but at least one of the things that's going on is that there's this tension, there's this weird ambivalence about finding something to be beautiful and hoping that one will cease to find it so. And for that to be, for that to have the character of a paradox, it has to be that the attribution is an objective one, not a subjective one. Okay. So I said this is a talk in which I say six things. I've said four of them. The last two are quicker, I think. So I've been saying that attributions of beauty, if true, are objectively true. They're not true for me. I mean, they are true for me, but there's no interesting for me place that makes them true. They're true for everyone. They're just true. It's true of the things that are beautiful, that they're beautiful. These aren't subjective judgments. And you might be thinking to yourself, that's a crazy thing to think. Right? Isn't it manifest that different things are beautiful for different people?
After all, there are all sorts of people.
Finding all sorts of things beautiful. Are you saying that they're wrong?
No, I'm not. Because
those considerations, those that look lots of different people truly say of different things that they're beautiful,
that's not a reason to think that beauty is subjective.
That those phenomena can be accounted for by saying that beauty is context sensitive. Remember, those are very different things. Different people can truly be described as tall in different contexts, because the content of the word tall shifts from one context to another. Similarly, it can be true that different people truly describe different things as beautiful in different contexts. That doesn't require that the property they attribute is a subjective property. It just requires that different properties are being attributed in different contexts. And that's true that context sensitivity is not a form of subjectivity, even when we do mention the subject in specifying the context. So I said earlier when I was talking about how judging someone to be young, perfectly objective. The standard shifts, but once we fix the standard, it's up to the person, the object, to determine whether or not it's true that they're young. Think about something like a person judging that the glass is to the left of the bottle. That can be perfectly objective. There's, of course, a frame of reference required to make it true before we've even got a truth evaluable content from the statement that the glass is to the left of the bottle. And if you want to know what frame of reference is operative in this context, almost inevitably you're going to have to mention me, the subject of the judgment. But that still doesn't mean that the content of the judgment is a subjective content. Even, right, the role of the subject is kind of playing a merely reference-fixing role in those kind of contexts. That in order to work out which content is being attributed, you have to make reference to the subject. Even in those kind of contexts, that doesn't mean that the content itself is a subjective content. I think you can do a similar argument with actual and some modal operators, although there are more controversies there. I want to suggest that the considerations that seem to move us towards rejecting the objective view can be happily accommodated by thinking of beauty as being context sensitive rather than subjective. And we already see some evidence that it is context sensitive in that way when we look at the kind of paradoxes I've just been talking about. So, this sentence is just this diachronic more paradox that I've been talking about already. I think there's something paradoxical about saying an object is beautiful and hoping that you will cease to believe it. Much less obviously paradoxical to do the kind of semantically ascended version of that. To say this object is beautiful, and I hope I will cease to judge that sentence, this object is beautiful, to be true. The latter one could... You could get versions of the latter one to be true for anything at all, right? Because you could hope that the English language is going to change its meaning, or hope that you're going to cease to speak English or something. Even if you fix the semantic features of English, I think 5b doesn't quite have the ring of paradox. So it's a bit easier to see if you change the example, so I'm going to do that. So if we think about height, about tallness, 5a now says this wall is high, and I hope that I will cease to believe it. And that should make you go, no, don't hope that. That's hoping that you'll have come to have a false belief. Diachronic more paradox. Whereas 5b sounds much less like a crazy thing to think. This wall is high, and I hope that I will cease to judge this wall is high. 5b, I hope that I will cease to judge, quotes, this wall is high, close quotes. That sounds like something that, you know, a child who is hoping to grow up might think. I hope that ceases to be true for me. This wall is high. Now, if that's right, if you share that intuition that 5b there doesn't have the ring of paradox, whereas 5a does, I think you're already committed to the idea that predications of highness can change their meaning in different contexts. Right? Since, after all, the only difference is that we're kind of making the predication here in this context, and here we're making the predication in a different context. So if you go, where are we? There we are. If you have that intuition about the case of beauty, if you think that this object is beautiful and I hope I will cease to believe it, sounds tricky. Not impossible, but paradoxy, Dark Lady-ish. Whereas this object is beautiful and I hope that I will cease to judge that, that could have more of the flavour of the child who was hoping to grow up, the person who's hoping to start moving in more refined circles, or something would be the equivalent, it merely hopes that the predication will cease to be true, not that the content predicated will cease, that the predication will cease to be judged, that the content will cease to be believed. If those feel different to you, then something like contextualism seems like it must be at work. So, I've said that contextualism can accommodate the kinds of considerations that make many people think they need to be subjectivists. And here, I think, there's already the beginnings of an argument that says we should indeed be contextualists of that sort. And now, just the final worry you might have is sort of just a digging in your heels worry. So, I've made all these moves in defence of this obligation view of beauty. Right. I've said there are facts about where the beauty is in the world, and we are under an obligation. In the same way that there's an obligation to believe the true, there's an obligation to love the beautiful. And now I've gone contextual, so exactly what the content of the obligation is going to shift from context to context. And now you might say, well, all right, so you've kind of defended that the obligation view requires there to be facts about beauty, it requires there to be the kind of facts that could place it under an obligation, and you've made moves against the things that put pressure on that. You said there are such facts, you said those facts can be objective facts. But isn't this obligation view of beauty still weird? Right? Isn't it still... you're saying that among the properties of the world, there are properties that place us under an obligation, and that's a kind of weirdly normative world you live in. The world isn't like that. It's just stuff. And yeah, I think that's a concern. But I don't think that's an objection. I think that's right. I think there is something funny about the idea that we are under an obligation to love the beautiful. But that's not a sign that the obligation view is false. It's just like the analogous thing with truth. So yeah, there is something funny about truth. How could it be? How could it be true of us that we're obliged to believe the truth? That we go wrong when we believe false things, right? That's all normative vocabulary. Going wrong, being obliged. How could the world be a world in which there are obligations of that sort? That's a real puzzle, right? And it's just a puzzle in the philosophy of mind. How can there be states with truth conditions? There is something puzzling raised by this obligation view of beauty. But again, it's just a puzzle in the philosophy of mind. A deep puzzle and a hard puzzle, right? But it's there and we need to face up to it, right? And it comes back to this thing I said at the beginning, that the mind is not a hoard of sentences. So yes, there are going to be. Suppose the glorious day comes and we have a theory that explains how there can be mental states with truth conditions, we won't be done. Like, that won't be the whole of the mind explained. There'll be other facts about mentality still to be explained. And this obligation view of beauty indicates where one of those tricky problems is going to lie. But the fact that there are tricky problems in the explanation of the mind, that's not a reason to reject this as a theory of aesthetics. That's just a sign that there's always hard philosophical work still to be done. Thank you.